it's about the inhomogeneous universe, and it's about measuring the levels of inhomogeneities using various techniques, which I'll try to outline. So first I'll tell you in detail what S8 is, okay? And as I said, it's a measure of the fluctuations or the inhomogeneities in the universe. And the S8 problem, in a nutshell, is that the universe is less inhomogeneous than Planck predicts that it should be. Okay, when we measure it locally. All right, so if we take the matter density, subtract off the mean, and make a fluctuation field, which is usually labeled delta. Okay, so these are the averages. You can then have a delta field, and you can go around averaging that field over some radius. And by convention, the reason of the 8 is that people use an 8 H inverse megaparsec sphere to do that. Okay, so now you've got a smooth universe, and you go around and measure this quantity in spheres everywhere, and then take the RMS of those. Okay, and that gives you a quantity now called sigma 8. So that's a measure, by definition, the mean of this has to be zero, but it has a second moment standard deviation. All right, now S8 is a version of this. It's omega defined as omega matter to the point divided by 0.3 to the 0.5 power or square root times sigma 8. Okay, and this combination of parameters is basically chosen, particularly by weak lensers, as it fits the degeneracy curve of their data. Okay, so there's no deep physics behind the fact that this is to the 0.5 power. And by convention, with this measure, we extrapolate these values here. They both depend on redshift, but this is always extrapolated to redshift 0, assuming lambda CDM when we make this comparison. All right. So there's a bunch of ways to measure this. Let's start with the CMB, which Will already introduced. Okay. So I like this plot. I dug it up after with some Googling because it shows you three different generations of space-based maps of the CMB. This one doesn't look much better than WMAP, but it has actually higher resolution and better sensitivity. Although you don't see it with your eye. You certainly see the improvement from COBE to WMAP. Okay, and these are the peaks that we already saw. And so as Will described, and he quickly showed you a table, and it included a sigma 8 in that table if you were keen-eyed, you fit the cosmological parameters in the context of lambda CDM, flat lambda CDM, and then you extrapolate those using just linear perturbation theory to the present day. And you predict what the linear value of sigma 8 should be today, what the value of omega matter should be today. Okay? And so when you do that, you get the following answer. So here's this S8 parameter. Okay, ignore the blue line for now, but that'll come back later. So you can do this with any CMB experiment. Back in the days of WMAP, the errors were quite large. You notice the central value is a little bit lower, but certainly no significant. Planck went through a few iterations. This is the most recent one. And it shows that this value should be around 0.83. Okay. Incidentally, this has been reanalyzed using the higher resolution ACT data and combined with the WMAP, so they make another measurement completely independent of Planck, still based on the CMB. It gets about the same central value, bigger error bars. Okay, so this value is not just coming from Planck. It's coming from, seems to be coming from the CMB.
SBT,
this one has even larger error bars. I don't know if anybody's tried to do this kind of combination. Presumably, as time goes on, these will update. This is consistent with this blue line that I'll talk about, but it's also consistent with this red line. So it's not a very discriminating. And even this one is not so great either. It's the Planck one has the very small uncertainties. All right. So, yes, comment?
So H is fixed in that, H naught to get those?
Yeah, these are just So you do a joint fit of all the cosmological parameters. Each model will have whatever its best fit H naught is, but they presumably also agree with the Planck value of H naught as well. I haven't looked to see what the H naught is for this case, for example. But you do the six parameter fit, and you extrapolate to the present day.
Consistent, probably internally or something.
Yeah, I'm sure it's consistent internally. Okay, so the S8 problem is, I'd say, the most powerful data set is weak gravitational lensing. And so I'll just show you this one picture. I won't go through all the math, but hopefully it'll give you the flavor. Basically, here's a simulated artificial map where you have a single lens here. Okay, and these fuzzy blobs are some background galaxies. This is a very old image. So close to the mass, you see a strong distortion in a tangential direction. But what your eye can't see as well, particularly because galaxies have all different shapes, is that even far away from that, this is a little blow up of this square, there's a tendency for these galaxies to be tangentially aligned. Okay? And so in the method of weak lensing called cosmic shear, what you measure are correlations between the shapes of background galaxies. So this one is tangentially stretched this way, and this one is tangentially stretched, and so there's a correlation in their distortion. And that correlation, so galaxies, you can plot that correlation as a function of separation, and a model where, a realistic model for the universe where you don't just have one mass, but you have a Gaussian field of masses, will predict what those correlations should be. Okay, and so the more mass there is, the stronger the distortion and the stronger the correlations. So in general, there'll be a fluctuating field in front of it, and that'll induce correlations in the shapes of more distant background galaxies. Of course, you can't see the mass. It's mostly dark matter, right? But the trace is in the correlated shapes of the distant galaxies. From an observational point of view, this is very technically challenging because the amount of distortion from, let's say, if you had a perfectly circular, a galaxy might be as low as 10 to the minus 3. And you're doing this in the presence of distortions from the atmosphere, which is also warping everything. The twinkling of the stars is not necessarily isotropic. Okay, and it's likewise with the camera distortions and so on. Those might be a couple of order magnitudes higher. So getting all this right is really hard, and that's why it takes these large teams, a lot of simulation work, a lot of analysis work to extract the right numbers. So I will not go into any specific thing. I'll just show you one quick plot, and it's not to highlight this HSC, which is one of the major surveys, but rather to show you the two other slightly more statistically strong data sets. This is the Dark Energy Survey. This is another survey called KIDS. They're both these large bananas in this parameter space of omega matter and sigma 8. And the valley along here has that power of 0.5, right, that I mentioned when we defined S8. So it's really that the data here don't constrain you along this direction, but they constrain you perpendicular to it. All right, that tiny little orange thing is the Planck prediction. So you can then reduce it to a one single value of S8, all right, if you make the transformation that I showed you. Okay, so here's a summary plot of some weak lensing results. Over the years, I've tried to keep the list of these independent of each other. So early data sets, I was involved in this one called CFHT Lens. Obviously, the error bars were quite a bit larger. These are the more recent surveys over here. Okay, so the KIDS one we already mentioned, DES and HSC year 3. And when you plot them as S8, you see that, you know, you get reasonably small error bars from some of these. So these ones are all distortion of background galaxies. You can also distort the spectrum of the angular power spectrum of the CMB itself. Right, so you saw all those nice peaks. right? If a little portion of the sky is stretched, then the separation between the peaks increases, and if it's compressed, the reverse happens. So you can extract lensing information using the temperature anisotropies and their distortions as a way of figuring out the mass structure that's between us and the cosmic microwave background. Since the cosmic microwave background is at much higher redshift, that probes the mass distribution at a higher redshift as well. All right, so these last three ones here are all based on CMB lensing, okay? And so the ground-based stuff that's been done with galaxy lensing seems to give you a lower value. There's a little bit more scatter amongst the CMB lensing here. This one is using a sample of galaxies from the WISE satellite. This is work led by Alex Kraluski, who's been a postdoc at Waterloo Center for Astrophysics and here at Perimeter. Another similar sample based on DESI or DECALS luminous red galaxies and cross-correlating them with the CMB. And then very recently, like a month ago, this result came out from ACT, which is a Southern Hemisphere CMB experiment in the Atacama Desert. That's what the A stands for. So that one's interesting because it actually agrees with this red line, 0.83, whereas the rest all give you a lower value. So that's the state of the data in weak lensing at the moment.
Sorry, what was the red line again?
Pardon?
What was the red line?
The red line was that CMB. All right, so with the small errors, they're not shown here, should be really be a thin band, right? And the blue, we'll see later, is kind of an average to all the data sets I'm going to show you. But it's that blue line is dominated by the weak lensing, which has the smallest uncertainties. All right, so another method. So with all these methods, we don't want to just count galaxies because galaxies may not trace the underlying dark matter. In fact, we know that they don't, right? So all the methods have to find a way of using the galaxies to probe the fluctuations in the dark matter themselves. So in the case of weak lensing, they're just the photons which are getting distorted by the mass. In the case of peculiar velocities and redshift space distortions, which are closely related, as Will just introduced, overdense regions expand more slowly, underdense regions expand more quickly. This leads to a deviation between a local rate of expansion, and those deviations are called peculiar velocities. All right, so they respond to the underlying mass as well. So I'll spend a few minutes talking about those. I've done a lot of work in this area. So if you measure a peculiar velocity, you can take a redshift, right? That's easy, okay? This part, as Will introduced, is much harder to measure, getting a direct distance. And it's the difference between the two that's the peculiar velocity, right? So to measure this, you need either a standard candle or a rod. Supernovae is an obvious case. There are other standard candles or standard rods based on galaxies. But they have errors. So this is the error in the distance. And so an error in a distance in this combination will propagate to an error in the peculiar velocity here. All right. The other problem with these is they tend to be sparse and noisy. And because this error grows linearly with distance, this method using direct distance estimates only works at relatively low redshifts. Otherwise, the errors become very large. All right, so the other way to do it is statistically via a method called redshift space distortions. All right, and this has a different issues, which I'll try to describe in a second, but it's sort of a cosmic variance limited measurement, as I'll explain in a second. The third way, which is maybe a new way and is only just starting, is to use a method called the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect, which is a scattering of the CMB photons off of hot gas in clusters. But that's a very new method, and I think it has potential in the future, but at the moment, they're only just getting detections. So just to remind you how this works, everybody understands how Newtonian gravity works. Okay, so a density maps into an acceleration with a 1 over r squared law. Right, and in linear perturbation theory, the peculiar velocities are proportional to the peculiar accelerations. Right, so this you can use your intuition. This delta, right, can be used to predict the peculiar velocities using a very similar equation. Instead of a density rho, we've got a delta here. And there's some other terms that come in front, right? And the important one that comes in front is this F. Okay, so F is the logarithmic derivative of the growth of perturbations. All right? So that's this D is a growth rate of perturbations in linear theory. And in a lambda CDM model, this is well approximated by just the matter density to the power gamma, where gamma is 0.55. Okay, so that's been verified analytically, numerically, et cetera. So this is very clear in lambda CDM that we've got omega matter to the 0.55. And that's nice because the other S8 definition is omega matter to the 0.5. So they're almost the same thing. All right, so nice to show the team. Here are the people who worked on this. Longtime collaborator Guillaume Laveau in Paris, former PhD student who also worked with Ghazal Sapranta, now in Arizona. My PhD student, Amber, who is finishing up and then moving on to Israel. So the basic idea works like this. We've got a bunch of observed peculiar velocities, okay? And we want to compare those to some predictions, right? Now, the predictions, we don't have the actual matter field, so we're going to use galaxies as a proxy for the underlying dark matter and assume a relationship between them. In particular, we're going to assume linear biasing, which means that the fluctuations in the galaxies are B, the bias factor B, just a simple number, times the underlying fluctuations in the mass. All right, so the equation I showed you before, I put in the delta of the galaxies, which I can measure, and an extra B appears here. And I measure this degenerate combination. Okay, so again, that's the same equation as before. Here's linear biasing. This is what I'm assuming. That means the fluctuations in the galaxies are related to the fluctuations in the mass. Okay, so this combination, I can measure this by comparing the predictions to the observations. I can measure the fluctuations in the galaxies just from making a map of large-scale structure. And when I put those two things together, the B's cancel out, and I get this parameter F sigma 8. Okay, and F, remember, in lambda CDM is omega matter to the 0.55 power. So it's almost the same as the S8 that we had before. All right, so that's how peculiar velocities work, and I'll show you the results in a second. The other method is closely related to what Will was just talking about, redshift space distortions. Okay, so in real or configuration space, if I was God and I could see all the velocities, I have an overdense region here, which is collapsing. So compared to the background expansion, there's inward peculiar velocities like this. Okay, but I can't, for large surveys, it's too expensive to actually measure those distances directly. It's observationally too expensive. But what I can measure is their redshifts. Their redshifts are cheap. Images are even cheaper, but redshifts are pretty cheap. Okay, and so because if I'm looking along the line of sight this way, these peculiar velocities, when I go from real space to redshift space, are perpendicular to the line of sight. So this, a point here, doesn't move, but a point up, a galaxy up here, appears to be down here in redshift space. And that means that an object which was round will become squashed in redshift space. Okay? Now, individual objects are not round, but when I average a whole bunch of them together, since there's no preferred direction in the universe, the sum of them should be round. Okay, and so that's shown in one early measurement of this. I think this is from the 2DF group. Will was possibly a co-author. I'm not sure. He says nodding yes. So this is the measurement of numbers of pairs along the line of sight and perpendicular to the line of sight. And it's squashed. And the degree of squashing tells you the amount of peculiar velocities. Okay, obviously, if these are stronger, then you get more flattening. Okay, so you can turn the problem around and figure out what is the typical peculiar velocity for a given overdensity. The weakness of this method is that you have to stack enough things to make it round. The smaller the volume you have, the fewer objects you're averaging over, and the less likely it'll be intrinsically round when you combine them together. Okay, if you think about it, if you're a Fourier person and your brain works in Fourier space, the modes that are along the line of sight are all compressed, and the ones that are perpendicular to the line of sight are not. And you measure a power spectrum this way and a power spectrum that way, and they're different, but from the ratio you can figure out how much squeezing there is.
What do the colors mean?
Just density. So they're just to help with the contours, yellow's I think.
Yellow's
high, green is low. But the contours, this is coming from random motions on very small scales, this spike here, but this flattening is coming from this effect here. It's sort of like a, looks a bit like an onion. Okay, so here's a bunch of measurements, both from direct peculiar velocities, all right, that we've talked about already. So I was involved in many of these down to here. In fact, all of them down to here. These are other groups. These direct measurements where you compare the density field of galaxies and the fluctuations from the peculiar velocities, if you average all those methods together, they give you this gray band here. I'm only averaging the ones that are trying to keep them independent because the data in here are a subset of the data in here, so I don't want to double count them. So the ones that are yellow, the ones that are white, I haven't counted in this simple average. Redshift space distortions, a second method I described, which is also peculiar velocity related, gives you a whole list of data points here from a number of different groups, many of which Will has been in particular these BOSS ones, which give you these very small error bars. And if you average again all the ones that are black here, you get a number around here. Again, this is the CMB line. Okay, just a plug for the classical peculiar velocity method. This, in all this data set here, there's only 20,000 peculiar velocities and about 70,000 redshifts. The redshifts are used to make the density field map, which makes the predictions. These are what we compare to. These samples are much larger. They have over a million of redshifts in total. So I show this in case there's somebody in attack and I want to plug the value of measuring this from this method. Time allocation committee for those people who are wondering what I say when I say attack. Those observers have to deal with. All right, we put in proposals for observing time.
The voice pushing it towards the higher values?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. It seems consistent. The error bars are big. This is from Will's PhD student, Alex Woodfinden. So they seem to be suggestive of a higher value, but the error bars are large. If you combine them together, they do give you a slightly higher value. All right, last method. I still got a bit of time. Cluster abundances. Okay, so the basic idea with cluster abundances is you go and you find clusters of galaxies, which are the most massive virialized objects in the universe. All right, and you count them per unit volume. The clusters are the remnants of an overdensity on a larger scale, which is roughly 8 megaparsecs, which, as Will showed in some of his models, has expanded and then recollapsed and virialized to form a bound object. So they're a tracer of the fluctuations on those scales. All right, and essentially, the larger the amplitude of inhomogeneities, the more clusters you have, all right? In practice, there's a catch with this method is that you would like to count clusters above some mass thresholds. You can't do that directly because measuring masses of clusters is pretty expensive. So you have to use some kind of proxy for the mass of the cluster, which is correlated with it, and then calibrate that relation with some other empirical measure of the mass, usually weak lensing. Right, so here's a very old example, but it's one I could pull up quickly. This is abundance of clusters above almost 10 to the 15 solar masses. Okay, that's what's shown here, is the number density, 3D number density of such objects in different bins of redshift. For a given set of cosmological models, which in this case assumes that omega matters 0.3, and the values here are different levels of the sigma 8 parameter. So the higher that is, the more clusters you predict. And then you measure them and you try to infer the value. This is quite old data, so it's just shown here for illustration. So there are different ways of finding clusters. You can find them through X-rays. You can find them through this Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect that I mentioned before. You can look for clumps of red galaxies, because the clusters of galaxies from their name are full of galaxies. Okay, and so the different methods are used here to try to identify those. The ones labeled SZ are from the Sunyaev-Zeldovich. These two are X-rays, and these two are based on optical detections of enhancements of galaxies. And in each case, you calibrate them to a mass, count the number above some threshold, and compare it to the prediction. And at the end of the day, you get this value S8. Okay, and so here are the different measurements. This one's unusual, not sure what's going on there. Could just be some screw up, right? Systematic errors happen. The rest of them don't scatter around too much. In fact, they scatter less than their error bars. Maybe they're being too conservative with their error bars. All right, so you put them all together, all those plots that I've shown you. Here's Planck up here, okay? So the peculiar velocities, the redshift space distortions, the weak lensing, cluster abundance. If you just naively average all these like I have, then these are sort of the significant difference from this red line that you would expect. If you go even further and put them all together, that's the value you get for this S8. And remember, it's 0.83 for the CMB. Okay, so if you try to do this formally, you would call it a 4.5 sigma deviation.
It's not 5.
Not 5, no. Not the way I've done it here. It's in the ballpark. All right, so that's the nature of the S8 problem. And I think, for me, an interesting fact is that these are all different methods with very different systematics, presumably. Most of the individual measurements seem to be pointing in the same direction. There are some few exceptions, like this is very low, this one's very high, this one's a bit low, this one is a bit low. You know, if you have 20 measurements, you expect one or two sigma outliers. So one point of view is that this is all consistent with this picture. I haven't actually calculated the chi-squared, but I'm guessing it's probably all right. All right, so solutions. So Will talked about early dark energy as a solution to the H-naught tension. So this is a review paper by DiValentino. It has 1,000 references in it. I don't know if that means there's 1,000 papers on exactly the subject, but it's of that order, right? So Bianchi type 1 space-time is number 999 here. These ones are excellent solutions to the Hubble tension, early dark energy, we heard, right? They're different versions of early or dark energy, presumably by different authors, which don't work quite as well. There are some that help a little bit, but don't help as much. So great, we think. That's wonderful for theorists. We got a whole range of possibilities to explore. Follow-up paper, which considered the H-naught and this S8 tension, okay, includes this, one of the same authors. It would be appealing and compelling if both the H-naught and SH tensions were resolved at once. But as yet, none of the proposed new physics models have done so to a satisfactory degree. By which I assume that all these, as Will mentioned briefly, don't help the S8 problem, or maybe even make it worse by raising the value that you would predict from extrapolating from Planck. So there's an opportunity here for someone to come up with one that does both at the same time. But none of these thousands have worked so far. All right. How much time have I got?
5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay. So this doesn't solve the problem, but I've played around a little bit, but with what happens if you change that power gamma, which is 0.55 in lambda CDM, maybe it's a better parameterization. And if you do that, you can reconcile, the CMB with the lower redshift measurements, All right? But of course, you've now broken lambda CDM, and you have to have some other explanation for it. So can such a model work, right? Many people have looked at this before, just as sort of empirical way. Let's just fit this as a free parameter. Most recently, these authors, Nguyen, Hooter, and Wen, claimed, this paper only came out a little while ago, that they find that this gamma is 0.633, right? And it fits, they claim it fits very well. And that's 3.7 sigma different from the lambda CDM value. They were a little bit selective about what data sets they chose when they did this analysis. So it's always nice to present something new at a meeting that hasn't been published. So I played around with this. So I'll take 5 minutes to show you what I think about this. The nice thing about changing gamma from an observational perspective is if it's lambda CDM, S8 and this F sigma 8 were almost the same thing, because the power of omega matter in F is 0.55. But if you break that and you make this a different number, then the data sets can change. So here's my attempt to do this. These are the same data sets I showed you before, okay, but now as a function of redshift. So the things which measure S8 directly, in other words, they're not involved in the growth of perturbations, clusters and weak lensing, are shown here. Okay, so these are the values of S8 that you would get taking, assuming lambda CDM with a gamma of 0.55 and projecting forward to the present day. So in these two models, the blue and the orange, gamma is 0.55, so that's why those models are flat lines. If you allow gamma to deviate from the lambda CDM value of 0.55, you get some curvature in here, right? So this is the model that I just mentioned by Nguyen, Hooter, and Wen, which has a gamma of 0.633. That's the green line, okay? And so their argument is that at high redshift, you get the CMB value, and at lower redshift, you get a lower value. But they didn't use all this data when they did that fit. In particular, they omitted these two very tightly constraining weak lensing data sets. So the other night, I was just eyeballing this fit, you know, chi by I. So what happens if you crank up the gamma even more? All right. And I'll make it so that it goes to 0.77 as we approach low redshift. A little bit of a better fit. Yeah, so this is the red curve. You know, it hits closer to these points with the small error bars, which really drive it. This guy, nothing fits, so doesn't really matter so much, right? And these curves also have the advantage of going through that ACT CMB lensing point, which is one of these ones. I think it's this one. But they miss some of the other CMB lensing points, which are also at high redshift. So it's not clear what's going on at high Z. So by eye, this one might be a slightly better fit, this red one. The orange one, which is the low S8 model, is pretty good fit to most data points, misses this guy here. And of course, it doesn't hit the CMB. That's the whole problem, right? Now we can play the same game with F sigma 8, which is coming from peculiar velocities. And that has a different sensitivity now because gamma's changed as well. All right, so if you do that, you get the following.
Excuse me.
Yep, there's a question.
What you have to change in your model to increase gamma?
There's no physics to this. It's purely just a parametric model, okay? So I haven't said anything about what this means. I don't even know what it means, right? But in general, different modified gravity models will predict a different gamma, right? So right now I'm just fitting for gamma, or trying to fit for gamma, and we'll see if it works. So here's a peculiar velocity which are sensitive to this change in gamma in two ways. It changes sigma 8 because it changes the derivative, so it changes how sigma 8 grows with time. And then it also changes it directly through the F. The blue line, again, is Planck, right? So it shoots over most of the data. The orange line is the one we saw before. Not terrible, kind of misses this data point here. The Nguyen one is a reasonably good fit to here. And this one that I've just eyeballed is actually too low now. So the moral of this story for me is that I actually don't believe this, because while this Nguyen model with modified gamma is a good fit to these data, it's not really that great a fit up here. Okay. The orange model with a low S8 fits this nicely. It's not a terrible fit to these data points, but of course it doesn't fit the CMB. So my conclusion from this little experiment over the last couple of days is that modifying gamma, to me, does not seem like it's going to solve this problem. And the reason for that, I think, is that when these authors here did this fit, they omitted a lot of these data points, which are quite constraining, particularly a lot of the weak lensing ones, where they used earlier versions from DES year one, for example. So that may have looked like a good fit to the data points they included, but when you put in all the data, this green line is not such a great fit. So no answer there, all right? If we had more time and somebody actually thought about this, we could maybe see if there's any evidence of a scale dependence. Because these different methods probe different co-moving scales. Some are more sensitive to large scales, some are sensitive to smaller scales. Maybe we could make a plot similar to that, but as a function of the average scale probed. You know, my gut nobody's measured this very carefully to my knowledge. At least they don't put it as a column in the table, which says, you know, what is the mean wave number K where most of the signal comes from, right? But my guess is that the weak lensing is maybe the smaller scales, then probably clusters, then the peculiar velocities the way I've described them, and maybe on larger scales, the redshift space distortions. That's just a hunch, suggestion for someone to look at. Okay, so we have no answers to this problem, is a short summary. The future looks good. I won't go through these because I think I'm out of time. There's a number of missions that are just going to increase the data sets by orders of magnitude, or at least an order of magnitude, presumably bring down the error bars by factors of a few until they hit the systematics floor, which may mean that it's not quite a reduction that we would like, all right? So we heard earlier in this meeting, shut up and calculate, attributed to Feynman, but not really his. I think it's Merman's, David Merman. That's fine for theorists. If you're an observer like me, I think the answer is shut up and just measure. Thanks.
I didn't hear something I expected to hear, so I might have just missed it, but what assumptions about the dark matter underlie all this analysis? Like, is fuzzy dark matter one of the possibilities that's already been considered and ruled out?
So people are looking at fuzzy. I think the trouble with fuzzy dark matter is models like that are relatively young, and they're still at the stage where they're trying to make predictions of what that model can do, right?
But I guess I'm at zeroth question. Is the tension only a tension if we have non-fuzzy dark matter?
The tension is a tension if, as far as I know, if the CDM in lambda CDM is relatively massive, right? It's a relatively massive particle,
so
right?
I would think.
But
my guess is that it will be, first of all, that will not change because we are talking about 8 megaparsecs. So you'll have to change the dark matter properties on the quantum scale of 8 megaparsecs in order to be able to
warm dark matter again has been ruled out by, you know, a lighter particle has been ruled out by other measurements of the shape of the power spectrum. So there may not be that much room to fix the problem.
Yeah, so I have a question about trying to resolve both the H naught and S tensions. I was wondering if the picture I have of the physics is right, which is that for H naught, the early dark energy is essentially changing the scale factor of the early universe, whereas the S8 tension would be, if you're trying to find a physical model or resolve that, you're changing the growth of linear perturbations.
Yes, that's exactly right. So it's the growth of linear perturbations, which you can do in the context of the standard model if you tweak the expansion rate, because the way that the fluctuations grow is coupled to the way the universe expands. without even modifying gravity. But as Will showed from supernovae and BAO and other measurements, there are actually quite tight constraints on how the universe is expanding in the recent past.